Thank you, Rob. And yes, above all, thank you very much for, you know, the opportunity of visiting PI here and work with you guys. It's been really, really nice so far. Yes, I'll talk about causal decompositions of unitary maps. Joint work with John Berrydin and Gustavo Nedvelte, who was also in Oxford and is now a postdoc of Pablo Rigi in Paris. This has been going on for a few years. I suppose the subtitle speaks for itself. I assumed I would be giving a sort of somewhat introductory and overview talk. So looking at the audience, I apologize if it is a bit boring to those who already know all of this. This will come in three parts. I'll start by developing the notion of a causal decomposition and then the question that's associated with that. Then we have a second part, which is quite quick and sort of high level, so I won't be very slow and careful defining everything and just sort of try to point to a few situations where knowing these causal decompositions is useful. If some of the terms that appear are not so familiar to you, don't worry. That will be quick, and then move on to part three, where we return to the actual question of the talk, really. Right, so this will mostly be based on this paper with John in 2020, but also some of the other earlier and later works and some of more recent developments and perspectives. So just to get some bits of notation out of the way, there will be just finite dimensions throughout the talk, not because there's a principle or fundamental limitation. In fact, the way I will present things today, which is not quite as it was in the paper, should help extend to infinite dimensions. But the problem is hard enough in finite dimensions for me, so this is just about finite dimensions for now. I'll denote system A with a Hilbert space H sub A, and then the operator algebra of operators over H A just with here with this capital A, the unitary channel induced by a unitary map from A to B is then denoted with a curly U. And last bit of notation, so for the Joyce-Murkowski representation, we use this convention that I'm sure here anyone who has worked or discussed with Rob would be familiar with, this convention where a CP map from A to B is represented by an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of B and the dual of A, just so this is a basis-independent and positive operator. These operators will make some appearance, but they won't be too crucial in the way I present things, so don't worry. This is just to state it to convention. Right. So in this first part, about causal decompositions, there's two words to explain, I think. So first, what is this causal about? Here's the definition of causal no influence or causal influence. So given a unitary U from AB to CD, we say that A does not influence D if there exists a decomposition, well, if this condition here holds, so if there's a channel C such that this equality holds. And conversely, if this fails, then we say A does influence D, and we may also sometimes say A is a direct cause of D. So there's a bunch of equivalent statements.
Yeah. Sorry, the channel C has to be unitary?
No, it won't be in general. That I'm sure you're familiar with. So on the left, all these three are kind of literal restatements. At the top is a diagrammatic version of the statement in the middle, this condition. And at the bottom is just the same in CJ operator language. And then on top right, we have what is, I guess, normally called a no signaling condition. So it's also equivalent. So if A prime is trivial, so there would be a preparation of a state. And you can see that the marginal state on D is independent from what a state you feed in here. If A prime is the same as A, then this could be a quantum instrument. And no matter what intervention you do on A, the state on D, again, is independent. But there's also two more equivalent conditions. The one here, I should say, you know, this is also a bit introducing another convention. So for the algebra D, I'll use the same D to also denote seeing it as a factor subalgebra in the larger algebra on C and D. So I write D when really it is identity on C tensor D. And then the statement here is that this subalgebra D moves through U dagger, it's again a subalgebra, and it has to lie within B, i.e. it acts trivially on A. And that's also equivalent to this commutation relation that this subalgebra U dagger of D commutes with A. So that means, you know, every element of the two algebras commutes with each other. Right, so these equivalences hold, you know, just as much for arbitrary CPTP maps and talking about no signaling. But there are some special properties unitaries have that are worth pointing out now. So given a unitary from some number of input factors to some number of output factors, we just define sets for every output system BJ. We call them the causal parents. Now, this is an anticipation of some graphical language, but for now, this is just a set. And it's a set of inputs that actually do influence that particular output factor BJ. And then there's a theorem that says that the CJ representation of this unitary U factorizes in this way into pairwise commuting operators. So every factor here, and I should say, you know, this is using the same sort of convention of suppressing identity operators to make it a well-defined product. So here, every factor represents, in CJ language, the marginal channel from those inputs that actually influence BJ into BJ. And because sometimes some inputs can really, say, A1 really influences B1 and B2, hence it's in both parental sets, hence both corresponding factors act non-trivially on it and yet commute. So this is a very non-trivial condition that this happens. And it doesn't hold for arbitrary CPTP maps when you know, you could similarly define the subset of inputs that can signal to one output, but the CJ operator doesn't factorize that way, and that it has consequences we will look at in a moment. And actually, much of this quantum causal model work is really kind of exploring this factorization property of this operator, you could say. And in the earlier works where this was first used, the proof of this fact resorts to some yet earlier results in quantum information theory, sort of quite involved results. And I think actually there's a proof in just two lines. It's actually a very simple fact that we could look at the end if you're interested in. So I put this here, but it won't be too important for most of the talk. So here's another important special property unitaries have that you can see as an immediate consequence from the theorem we just saw. We call this causal atomicity. And what it says is that suppose A1 does not influence B1 and also not B2, then it is necessarily the case that it does not influence the joint. Once more, this is not something that would have an analog for arbitrary channels. So if you have a channel and some input that does not signal to, say, B and also not to B prime, it may well signal to the joint BB prime. And this fact really is behind the reason that causal structure of a unitary is fully determined. You know, by causal structure, I mean the set of all the causal relations that obtain for all the possible subset of input systems and output systems, and that is fully determined by these sort of single system influence or no influence conditions, which isn't true for an arbitrary channel. You would have to state all the signaling and no signaling relations between arbitrary subsets of systems. So that said, we can really represent the causal structure of unitary as a DAG. And here's the third and last special property I want to mention about unitaries. And that is, you could say, there's a symmetry or reversibility property of causal structure. So for unitaries, it's the case that input AI influences upper BJ if and only, so relative to U, if and only if BJ influences AI relative to U dagger. So if you look at the DAGs, it's literally a matter of flipping the arrows. Right. Let's just summarize. So the causal structure of a unitary, you can state as the family of parental sets, which means, you know, all these inclusion relations of subalgebras, or equivalently as the, you know, the set of inputs children sets. So you start with n commuting factor algebras, you move them through U because of unitarity, they are still commuting. So you get n new, still pairwise commuting subalgebras that are sort of delocalized with respect to the B factorization, if I look at this. And just a last bit of notation. So you've seen this sort of diagram. So sometimes we represent causal structure by DAGs. So here arrows mean causal relations. Sometimes I draw no influence conditions that then red dashed arrows. And the third way that will be very convenient is this. So here I draw, or I put a vertex for each input system, and then a hyper edge for the parental sets. And I guess it's already clear why that's useful, because that really sort of makes very clear what the overlap between the parental sets is. Right. I hope that's clear and is, you know, makes clear what the causal structure bit is, and now what are these decompositions about. Obviously, interrupt me anytime when something is not clear. So here's the first simple example of a unitary U with two inputs, two outputs. Suppose these indicated no influence conditions hold. Well, then that unitary factorizes into two unitaries. So that's to say there exist unitaries V and W, so that equality holds. You know, this is a fact that has been proven in various papers over the past 15, 20 years. Here I'll just note that it's kind of almost obvious in the language that we've already seen. So the CJ operator factorized in this way, where really the non-trivial action is on non-overlapping spaces. So really it's a tensor product. And the tensor product of CJ operators is just a representation of the tensor product of maps. And then due to purity, they have to be unitaries. Or you look at these inclusion relations of subalgebras, and because of unitarity, really U of A1 just has to be really the same as B1, and you're also done. So it's kind of straightforward. Look at the next case. Here's some unitary with three input and three outputs. Suppose A3 does not influence B1. Then in a paper by Schumacher and Westmoreland quite a while ago, they showed that this implies a circuit decomposition of this form, i.e. the existing unitaries V and W again, such that when you compose it, you get back U. And the point here is, again, it makes this no inference condition evident because there's no path from A3 to A1. I guess maybe I should have said that is also the case here, right? So that you can really see why it is the case that there's no influence. So the proof of this, I won't go into that now. We could do that later. Let's first sort of develop the idea. And maybe I should say really what is important is that circuit diagrams are sound for causal relations or for causal influence, you know, so long as you fill them with unitaries. So that's to say, whenever there is no path from an input to an output, there really is no influence in the corresponding unitary. And it is for that reason that this concept of a causally faithful diagram makes sense. And that is that, you know, we call a unitary circuit diagram representing U causally faithful if it has the property that there's a path from an input AI to an output BJ in the diagram, if and only if there actually is influence from AI to BJ in the unitary that is being represented by the diagram. Right. So here is the first sort of case how we will state theorems in most of this talk. The idea here is given some unitary U, if it has the causal structure S on the left-hand side, that implies a decomposition S on the right-hand side. You have not filled the boxes to just not avoid clutter, so these are just unitaries. And in all of these cases that are beyond this slide here, you just see that certain causal structures imply particular causally faithful circuit decompositions. And maybe one comment here is if you look at this guy in the middle, so you have this fixed factorization into three factors with the domain and codomain relative to which the causal structure was defined in the first place. And what this business of finding causally faithful decompositions, in this case with circuits, is about is sort of revealing a different decomposition, in this case still with factor algebra. So you can sort of take a slice through this diagram here and you see you now have six factors, two coming out of each of the input. And it's sort of now very clear what's happening with the causal structure, right? This left factor coming out of A1 goes to B1, whereas the right factor goes to B2, and so on. And one might then ask the natural question, call this hypothesis 1, that all unitaries have causally faithful circuit decomposition. Well, obviously, this is false, otherwise this wouldn't be a talk today, I suppose, when it was in the abstract. And how do we see this is not the case? Well, we've earlier seen these two circuit decompositions expressing corresponding no inference conditions. Suppose a unitary U satisfies both these conditions at the same time. Then none of these circuits above simultaneously express all there is in terms of causal structure of U. There is, of course, a circuit with the right connectivity, this one. So unitary of this form will always instantiate these conditions. But it's not the case that all unitary with the property on the left-hand side have a decomposition as on the right-hand side. And one way to see this would be there do exist unitaries with this causal structure, but with A2 prime dimensional system. And then there's just no way that A2 could factorize non-trivially into the two factors, which, however, would have to be the case if A2 really does influence B1 and B3 as the causal structure would have it.
Is it necessary to have the constraint for this that those boxes there represent unitaries? Like if they represented CP, like if you had some tracing over things in those boxes, could you do it then? Because just you mentioned the prime dimension, like you could.
So you can draw diagrams with CPTP maps, but if they are to be faithful, they should, and you know, in not introduce further input system and output system, then they would still have to go beyond the circuit diagram. I think we will come to that later. Yes. But for now, the question is, can we decompose it in terms of just unitaries? Right. So the point, of course, is that there is a decomposition that is implied by these causal constraints. So here's a theorem that says, well, if this unitary satisfies these two no-influence conditions, then there exists a bunch of spaces in unitary so that when you compose them, as in the middle, you get back U. And maybe the thing to notice here just is that a direct sum appears. And a much better way to explain this result is not by looking at this statement, but by drawing pictures. So here's the first version of how to represent this data that appeared in the theorem. So unitary U with these conditions implies the following decomposition. Now, in a way, it looks exactly like that circuit we've just seen. It's the same sort of topology, the same connectivity of a diagram. The only difference is that this index I is floating around. So what does this diagram mean? So let's first look at slices through this diagram and see what Hilbert space is associated with the slices. So the very bottom and the very top are just the ordinary, you know, tensor product of three factors. And then here we have factors A1 and A3 on the very left and the very right. And this middle factor is in fact a direct sum over I of what I here denoted xi left and hxi right. So you could say the left y is associated with a family of Hilbert spaces called hxi left, and this right y is xi right. And the fact that the same index appears in the both y's tells you to construct this Hilbert space, which is a direct sum of xi left tensor xi right. And similarly up here, we just call them yi left and yi right. And then the maps that mediate between these slices, here it's just the unitary s and t up here. And in the middle, a direct sum over vi tensor wi, where vi and wi have the corresponding domain and codomain for this to be well typed. So we will, you know, I'll explain more about this diagram. Basically, there's, you know, there's two aspects out of this result. One is how to prove that such a decomposition exists, and the other one is how to represent it diagrammatically and what is this language in which this thing here lives. These are two distinct questions, right? And let's start with the latter. And in, you know, these sort of things were at some point called dot diagrams. I still hear this word. Then in this paper with John, we called them extended circuit diagrams. And what we did, we gave precise semantics to interpret any diagram we drew. We didn't really define a language. We didn't really say what lives in this language and is it really compositional. And that was done then in a later paper by Augustin, Claire, and John, where they introduced this language called rooted quantum circuits, which has a special case, a subfragment of the language, which is index matching, and that's equivalent to extended circuit diagrams. So what they've done is very important, established important facts, namely that this is really a well-behaved language. So you can really take what the diagram suggests to us seriously. You can make sense out of every bit and then compose it, and it is still making sense in what you think it represents. It's also still sound for no influence, which is of course important, otherwise it would be no good for our question. So if there's no pass from an input to an output diagram, it implies there's no influence in the unitary of a corresponding kind. Hence, the notion of a causally faithful decomposition in terms of this index matching rooted circuits makes sense. So because we won't need the non-index matching, as it were, part of language today, I won't introduce that. But because it is, you know, a very nice paper and the right kind of language to talk about these questions, I'll kind of use that graphical notation from their paper, just only slightly adjusted, and all I will do now is try to explain enough so that we can really read every diagram we see today. And a first simple fact, you know, given a unitary from some space X to Y, if you pick a set of projectors on X, then which induces a subspace decomposition of the space X, then that through U induces, of course, a corresponding subspace decomposition of Y and vice versa. And this is mostly to say that, you know, the restriction of U to this I subspace I'll call U sub I. Okay. So this was one bit we saw in this diagram, and this we've already seen represents a unitary from the Hilbert space of A2 to this direct sum over I H X I left, H X I right. So one way in which my graphic notation differs from the rooted circuit paper, if you read that, is I suppress the labels of intermediate spaces, just like we often do in circuit diagrams, and just keep what's really necessary, which is the index. And the point here is that, you know, this is much smaller, this space, and is a subspace of this larger Hilbert space, which would be the tensor product of the two independent direct sums, right? And you can maybe already see what this not index matching rooted circuit language might be about. Right, you can imagine this, an I here and a J there, not necessarily the same, and then just specifying some other subspace of this that is mapped into by this unitary S. So we also had this map, this bit, this T, which represents a unitary from a corresponding Hilbert space here, constructed with these same I's here, into B2. We had a bit like that, where now, instead of writing VI into the box as we used to a while ago, now it just states there's a unitary V, and the fact that a wire with index I goes in and comes out imposes a constraint on the form of this unitary V, namely that it is block diagonal with respect to this sectorial decomposition by this projectors indexed by I, basically. And then if you put two such things next to each other with the same I on them, the rule you have to do is that represents a direct sum over just one I of VI tensor WI, and it's of this block diagonal form. So that then, indeed, this diagram is sort of a well-timed diagram and represents this unitary. So I hope
that... Can I ask a question?
Yes?
Yes. When you draw circuit diagrams, at least for some of them, you draw arrows on the wires. And when you switch to these rooted diagrams, there are no arrows. Is it true in general that for the rooted diagrams, there are no arrows?
Sorry, what arrows in circuit diagrams are you referring to?
The wires.
So usually people wouldn't draw arrows in circuit diagrams unless they were sort of in a situation where they want to do a CPM construction and sort of talk about CPTP maps. And double. And then,
I'm perhaps confused. Could you turn back to the slides of the circuit diagrams? And any one of them.
This one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Previous ones. I see. Here there are no arrows. But I do remember seeing some arrows.
Oh, sorry. You mean. So this is going to take a while. These arrows here on the left?
Yes.
Right. So these arrows, you know, are just stating properties of this unitary map. They're not somehow themselves internal structure in a compositional sense. They're stating facts about the unitary. And we are trying to flesh out in a compositional way.
Yeah, OK. Okay? I understand it. The real question is, when you go to the rooted diagrams, there's a statement about bending paths when there is a path. Some slides before this, something about the paths representing causal structure faithfully, but that's not the word you used. I think it's maybe the second slide of the wired, the rooted diagrams.
Here or?
More before this. There's some statements in words here.
This one? No.
Next one here. The second one, sound for no influence. If no path from input A to output B, in diagram on the diagram on the left,
yeah,
is it true that A1 does not influence B3?
Yeah. So sorry. The thing is, here I was just talking about what the diagrams mean, whereas earlier I was stating a theorem, which means given a unitary with particular causal structure implies a decomposition of this here. So here, of course, it's understood that we are representing a unitary that is such that there's no influence from A1 to B3. And the point I'm making here that, you know, the fact that there's no path in the diagram is reliable. You know, you can trust the diagram, you can trust the language to express exactly what you want.
That's my confusion. That's where my confusion is. On this diagram, how do I see there's no path from A1 to B3?
Sorry. So yes, I read diagrams bottom up, and this is about directed path, not about sort of going back, right? This is not allowed. Maybe I should have said that clearly, right? So if you go from here, the only path that exists to output is the one that goes straight up to B1 and the one that goes via here to B2. But if you want to go to B3, you would have to sort of go back, which is not the sense of path we are referring to.
Then isn't it true that the diagram actually are directed? There are actually arrows on the wires.
This is just the fact that that this diagram represents a map that has a domain and a codomain and it points in a certain direction and no more than that. So is that fair to say? Or
you could put arrows on it, but it would make
any difference. I can draw an arrow this way to indicate the way to read the diagram, but I don't think there's more than that.
So mathematically, how do you understand this diagram? Is this a graph with some nodes and edges?
So and the syntax.
I'm wondering how this time foliation. You say the influence can only go upwards in this diagram. Here, of course, at the intuitive level, that's great. But at the mathematical level, if I want a pure mathematical description, how do I see this structure going upwards? If this is just a graph, I don't see that structure. There is a path connecting A1 to B3.
So sometimes the diagram does not look symmetric. In this case, it happens because the causal structure is symmetric. Nice. So in a way, it's a good fact that it looks the same way no matter which way around you look at it, because U is such that there's no entrance from A1 to B3 and not from A3 to B1. And if you think about U dagger, there's no entrance from B1 to A3 and not from B3 to A1. And both sets of these facts are expressed by this same diagram. So you could flip it upside down if you wanted.
Right. So at a mathematical level, what do you mean by this diagram?
Maybe in the light of time, is it maybe fair to move on and sort this out later?
I would just say, Ding, we read these the diagrams from bottom to top. So a path has to start at the bottom, and as it goes up, it can never go back down. So all paths are always moving up or left or right, but never down. That's a path. So if the path never goes
right. The question is, at a mathematical level, how do you encode this information?
There's just a definition of what a path is, and then you show, and that is what was done here. In this paper, actually, there's also a proof that's not so nice in our earlier paper, that it is a fact that then there is no influence. You know, you just use the definition of influence and prove that fact, and that has been done.
I would suggest that you just allow that to draw arrows on all the wires, Robin.
Fine. Ding, please, from henceforth, consider there to be arrows.
Okay, sure, please go on.
So we were there. Right. So I hope that this was enough to make intuitive how to read the diagrams. I will say a few more things later, and if not, please ask. So now let's turn to this question, how does one prove the existence of such a decomposition given some causal structure. And in the earlier paper, this was done by inspecting the factorization property of the CJ operator. But I think it is nicer to stay a little bit closer to, well, I think really sort of at the heart of it mathematically. So let's not do that, as in going that route, but instead using what's at the heart of this, and that's just the one theorem about finite dimensional operator algebras that sort of everyone knows and uses. So here it says, given some subalgebra A, the operator algebra L of H, if this is a star subalgebra, so maybe, I don't know, we should say, so it being a subalgebra means it's a linear subspace and it's algebraically closed, and it being a star subalgebra, it's also closed under the dagger, so the conjugate transpose here. So if A is such a star subalgebra, then there exists a Hilbert space, this form that we've, you know, seen lots here, and some unitary that mediates between H and H triddle, such that up to this unitary isomorphism S, this algebra A is equal to a direct sum over the full matrix algebra over this left factor, tensor identity on the right factor. So with fewer words, if A is a subalgebra of L of H, and the sorts of algebras we encounter will all be star subalgebras, then this is basically unitary isomorphic to algebra of this form, but this is our convention to represent the full algebra on some Hilbert space XLF. And one can then read off immediately what the commutant is. So the commutant is just everything in the algebra that commutes with everything in the subalgebra A. And that is just, well, you know, if XLF is a full algebra, it's a trivial center, the only thing that commutes with it is the identity. And the algebra that commutes with the identity on the right factor, well, that's the full algebra. So you can immediately read off the structure of the commutant. And it's sort of these facts that one uses in the proofs, and that's kind of enough. Right, so in this case, the causal structure is this, which means that these inclusion relations hold. And I put here the result we want to prove, sort of to give us inspiration of what to do, maybe. So here's a subalgebra given by the intersection of two algebras. You know, this defines a subalgebra of B2. So, you know, now we know there is a subalgebra, hence there exists a decomposition of B2, you know, up to this isomorphism T that identifies that decomposition, such that this algebra F is basically the algebra YI left summed over I. And this algebra is exactly what this wire can be associated with. And I think this becomes very intuitive in the diagram, because you take the intersection of B2 with A1 and A2. So when you roll the algebra A1, A2 forward, in a sector B2, this wire is exactly representing that algebra you get thereby. And then one can, I'm not going to do all the details here. This is not to really memorize. It's just to convey some spirit of how this works. One can reason, convince oneself that the center of F is basically spanned by the projectors on these subspaces through U dagger, gets mapped into A2. So remember, earlier I said that if you pick some decomposition in the domain, through U, that induces the decomposition on Y. But that, in general, would cut across all of A1, A2, and A3. And the statement here is that actually, these projectors just cut subspaces into A2. Hence, we know this restriction UI is of a particular kind. Its input subspace has full factors A1 and A3, and just the subspace of an A2. This was already there from the earlier decomposition. And then we're almost done. We just observe two no inference conditions. And now we are basically back to the very first simple example where if you, partition the sets, the systems the right way, it's basically just this two-way no influence and the unitary factorizes. And these two factors are VI and WI when we're done. So this is, not too lengthy. There's some intermediate steps that I won't go into now. But this is the flavor of it, that's the sort of thing one invokes.
If I want to build this thing in the laboratory, can I look at that paper and it tells me how to do it?
To build the unitary?
To build it.
Good question, I don't know. I mean, I don't think generally, because there's no physical interpretation of what these subspaces mean.
You're claiming this is a part of physics in some sense.
Yes, I hope so.
So there must be, I mean, maybe you don't know what it is, but there must be some prescription for making it in the laboratory.
Yeah, I guess if a unitary is given a particular context and the systems have meaning, and then one can also interpret the subspace identified here, whether not having the specific context, whether one can come up with a recipe or something that, knowing a general decomposition, one can at least always give some operational meaning to it, should probably be possible, but I can't think of it at the top of my head.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello, hi. Can I give an example of a physical scenario, just maybe if you're confused?
Hello, Claire. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, Robin. So if you go back to the previous slide, maybe you can... Sorry, I don't know what happened to my window. There we go. So if you have a single photon traveling through two paths, and that is a specific example of this scenario here. So the subspace, if V has a cardinality, if the I set of I is a cardinality two, like there's V1 and V2, W1, W2, then you could have that V1 is the vacuum sector of a Fock space. W1 is a one particle sector of a Fock space. V2 is also a one particle sector, and W2 is a vacuum sector. Then S is an isomorphism that takes a single photon prepared in some path state. So this is where by a qubit into a superposition of going through the left path and the right path. That would be one particular example. And then V is a unitary that acts on the Fock space. The Fock space is a direct sum of many spaces, and for our purposes, we're only interested in the restriction of the unitary V to acting on the zero particle and one particle. And so it's a direct sum.
So this is, I guess, an instance of the former kind of man, right? Where there's a specific situation, everything has six dimensions, and the interpretation in terms of physics is very clear, and then you can understand what this decomposition means in a very direct and enlightening way. But that's not the same as what I think you were asking about, which is...
I think that was kind of clear.
Okay, cool.
It seems because interferometers aren't circuits in the sense that the beam splitters and don't actually represent boxes in a normal circuit sense. They represent something to do with tensor sum. And so maybe this, what Hello was saying, this is kind of connected to that in some way. That'll do for the time being for an answer.
Okay.
And then later on, I want to understand it.
Great. Yeah.
So maybe, Hilaire, is it fine if I go on? It's quite a bit to go
yes,
through.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So... there's then various decompositions one, you know, can derive. Here's one, here's another one, where now maybe two indices appear, and the unitary that's represented in this middle slice here is, you know, a direct sum of I and J, and has these component unitaries. And one then naturally forms maybe an updated hypothesis, right? So every unitary in finite dimensions has a causally faithful decomposition in terms of index matching, which is circuits. That's a new version. And before we continue with this question, we speed up and go to this much quicker second part where I change gears, won't explain everything in detail, just try to point in three directions, thinking most people here will be familiar with the concepts anyway. So first thing would be diagrammatics for causal models. So for classical causal models, you know, we've just had this causal inference workshop last week here. A classical causal model you could state as data of given by a DAG and a distribution of factorizers, or this set of stochastic maps. And equivalently, you can draw a string diagram for that. Very few have worked on that. And the data on the left is really sort of in one-to-one correspondence with the data on the right. And that's a very intuitive representation of the same concept of a model. And the same works for functional causal models. So you can draw a string diagram with the causal mechanisms being these functions, copy maps, these little dots, and the local noise terms, these exogenous variables introducing stochasticity into it. So for classical causal models, this thing of drawing a string diagram for the model is a matter of providing a much more intuitive representation for causal models. But there's nothing new conceptually, as it were. Everything that we understood in the representation on the left is kind of there on the right, and vice versa. Now, what about quantum causal models? So there exists a notion of quantum causal model that I won't define in great detail here. I think probably many people here will be familiar with it. The analog in this example is, you know, now the causal structure where the vertices are pairs of Hilbert spaces over which overall a higher order process is defined that's constrained by that causal structure. And the constraint is that the, you know, the higher order map CJ representation, this process operator factorizes into this way. Now, what about the right-hand side? Well, it always defines a comb, but that's kind of unsatisfactory because it doesn't really represent all there is to know and conveyed by the causal structure, by the causal model being this one. It only tells you that later nodes don't signal to earlier ones. Now, this notion of quantum causal model is grounded in the definition of causal structure relative to unit transformation. So really, when there's a causal model with these five nodes, then the idea is that factorization property we've seen witnesses the existence of a unitary process, called this U here, that has the same causal structure up to some local influences, just like we had in the classical analog or functional causal model, and some later guy F that may depend on everything to restore unitarity and the right sort of causal constraints. Then you can, of course, draw a unitary comb with some unitaries that gives back the original process when you discard F and feed in these states, but it's still kind of not really what one wants. Now, this unitary comb defines or is defined by however you want to see this, a unitary map from all the lambdas and all the output spaces of nodes to all the input spaces and F. Now, this is just a unitary map, and its causal structure in this case is in the hypergraph language represented by this thing. That's just its causal structure that comes from the assumption where this unitary came from. And that happens to have a known causal decomposition, that's the one on the right here. So now I can just draw, you know, do this business of bending wires back again and draw this more fine-grained, more informative diagram that now really expresses everything that is on the left-hand side, and actually even more, I think, in the following sense. So classically, there's this notion of autonomy of causal mechanisms, basically means the stochastic mechanism of sort of a variable xi given its parents, that's a channel, and you can replace this channel with any other channel by just keeping the typing and keeping the variables the same. And the overall distribution that's then defined by this new data is still a causal model. Whereas here, if you sort of naively thought, well, this operator represents a channel, if it just picks some other channel, so another quantum channel, from A1 and A4 to A5, well, its CJ operator is not going to commute with all the others. So somehow there's a constraint. And what this diagram does, it tells us really what is this data that you can freely vary over without losing this property that it satisfies the factorization constraint on the left-hand side. Because whatever you fill into the boxes here that are labeled, you do the marginalization, you get a process that factorizes on the left-hand side. So I would go as far as to say, unless we can really complete this program of causally, faithfully decomposing unitaries and drawing this sort of diagram, I feel like I don't really understand quantum causal models. It is only once I can draw this that I really understand them. And also then it becomes possible to define quantum causal models diagrammatically in the first place, just as much as I can do that classically. And if I want to, not even talk about CJ operators and process operators if I didn't want to. And in light of time, I won't say anything really here, apart from the fact that this idea of decomposing a unitary and then identifying pairs of spaces as belonging to a node and defining a unitary process, of course, doesn't care at all about this being an acyclic or cyclic structure. And this idea has then led to already lots of insights, I think, and the known causally faithful decompositions have helped to prove stuff in this realm of causally inseparable process operators. So whatever you think about indefinite causal order, I think they ought to be understood, and having these causally faithful decomposition is a mathematical tool to really study them better.
Can you go back to the translation between the causal structure and the...
Sorry, this is the wrong direction. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got this like T gate at the very end, which gets traced out. It's not connected to all of the internal ones. You got like connected to W, which I guess gives rise to A4, to V, which gives rise to A5, to the I's coming out of S. Why is it not connected to everybody?
Well, it doesn't. have to, because there can be influence from everyone to this one, but that is going to be mediated through the other ones. There's no influence condition, right? There's a path from everywhere to F. Or is that not what you were asking?
Okay.
It's just the contingent fact that this particular causal structure implies a decomposition of this kind, when, clearly F has a path from everywhere to it. But it doesn't mean you have to have an independent path from this one to F directly. It goes through these other ones. I hope that kind of answers the question. So this is already it for this part two. So we have seen utility for diagrammatics of causal models, and actually understanding quantum causal models. Also utility for studying indefinite causal order. I think it should give inspiration for maybe thinking about quantum realist causal inferential theories, something that was developed here. Inspiration for other foundational work to do with interpretations of quantum theory and counterfactuals. John Barrett has talked about these ideas and intuitions in previous talks. I won't go into there now. And actually, I think even problems in quantum innovation theory that have that are not explicitly causal should benefit from knowing what algebraic structure is implied by a unitary having a certain causal structure that you can then just exploit in proofs. So with this in mind, it seems to me one ought to figure this question out and answer the question whether this hypothesis is true or not and work out the causal decompositions. And so with that, let's return to the original question in this part three. We should just about be fine. Right, so what is known? For unitaries with two output systems and arbitrarily many input systems, it's kind of trivial. They always have causally faithful circuit decomposition. And by symmetry, the same is true for two inputs. And actually, for any unitary with at most three inputs or at most three outputs, there's a known decomposition.
Sorry, Robin, with the three, though, you need the indices. And for two, you don't.
That's right.
Yeah.
So some with three, they have a circuit decomposition. It's not that you cross a threshold and you always need rooted circuits. But once you go to three, some will need that more expressive language. Here's a particularly interesting example of a unitary with three inputs and four outputs that has that causal structure as on the left that implies a decomposition as here, where you now see sort of three indices floating around. And this algebra associated with this wire here is talking about sum over ij and k, and where you can see that every wire, sort of every factor in the subspace, depends on two out of the three indices, but these are not the same pairs for any of the two pairs wires that you compare them. And just to link back to the intuition that we had earlier, this algebra indeed is what you obtain when you intersect B4 with the rolled forward version of A2 and A3. This is what this wire can be thought to correspond to. Right, moving to four input, four output cases. This is what was in our paper from 2-3 years ago. So these cases we can do. You've actually already seen some of these examples earlier. And these cases, we don't know how to decompose. And sadly, this fact hasn't changed. This is still where it stands. Even though we have really worked quite a bit on this, and a particularly interesting example that's sort of an open case is this one, which is highly symmetric. So here's four input, four output. And AI does not influence BI for all I. So this, hence this very symmetric hypergraph. And here you can also see the same thing. So U of A1 acts trivially on B1, and that goes through in a symmetric way. And it's kind of...
So when you say you don't have to do this, do you mean you don't even know it's a part of physics, or you know it's a part of physics, you just don't know how to put it in your terms.
Right. So what one can write down unitaries with four input and four output systems that instantiate this causal structure.
You know that's possible.
Yes, that's possible. Actually, there is no combinatorial constraint. Any causal structure that you come up with by just picking some set of subsets has an instantiation if the dimensions are unconstrained.
So what you don't have is one of your diagrams with that.
That's right. So for a while, we didn't even know what to write down, what to conjecture should always exist. And then you know, after a while, we sort of came up with this diagram, which we still think within the realm of index matching rooted circuits, there is a decomposition, it ought to be this one. And I won't say too much about it, but just from, you know, working with these things, some intuitions form, and there are good reasons to believe it's got to be this one. Because, why? Well, you know, it has the right sort of symmetry properties. It looks the same this way around or that way around. In a way, A1 is the same as A2, A3, A4, up to permutation. It's just a different one. It doesn't influence. It's faceful. That's what our color coding here does, right? So the orange wires come out of A1, and the other orange wires out of B1, and they never meet. And the same for the blue ones, they never meet. That's just to visualize the faithfulness here. And then there's 12 different indices, so every decomposition introduces 3 indices, and then the way they distribute is quite sort of involved, but it allows them to recoherently up there without imposing seemingly unnecessarily strong constraints on the dimensions that can realize that. So, you know, this is just to make plausible, this was a good candidate to think about. And we thought quite hard about how to prove that this always exists. And here was one direction which there was sort of some hope. Saying was maybe already gives it away. Here is a case where, you know, let's forget about the fourth output. This is a similarly difficult situation of overlaps between subalgebras. Then I look at the flipped version. So instead of 4 inputs and 3 outputs, I now have 3 inputs and 4 outputs. Well, then that is a case we know how to decompose. That's the guy we've just seen a couple of slides ago. Hence, we also know that this unitary has a known decomposition by just flipping the diagram, basically. So that means here's a case where somehow the reasons deriving these decompositions seems to be hard does not imply that there is no decomposition. So it's not necessarily a dead end just because it seems harder. So what did we do here? Well, you know, these subalgebras correspond to these wires. And by decomposing the inputs, we managed to derive the decomposition. So one might start asking, no, how do I derive this uppercase independently? That will give me the clues how to make progress, right? And there has been some progress, but it's not finished yet. And the point at the end of the day is, it seems we now know anyway that the conjecture decomposition isn't the most general one, because Augustin very recently came up with a very concrete unitary U, which instantiates this coarser structure, where, you know, all the systems are qubits. And while it's not a hard proof, we're very sure that it doesn't admit of a decomposition of this kind. So while it seems clear that one has to go beyond index matching rooted circuits, we don't think that this particular example of a U evades a composition understanding. You know, there's some intuitions and ideas, and it's very much work in progress. And where does this leave us? Well, one option is, call this hypothesis 2.1, there's a mildly extended version of index matching rooted circuits. And then with respect to that, you can decompose any unitary. We are sort of trying to find what this mild extension could be. Option 2 would be, well, maybe we just move to something completely different, that is not sort of strictly a superset of the index matching rooted circuits so far. Maybe isometries, maybe SEDEX diagrams, maybe something else that still is informative and sort of reflective of causal structure. Or you might say, well, you sound like really just a believer. You believe there ought to be a composition understanding of causal structure. And every time you encounter a counterexample, you say, well, it's got to be true, but I just have to not found the most the expressive enough language in which to do this. Then one would start trying to, you know, write down some desiderata of what a good faithful decomposition should have and derive a no-go theorem. You know, logically, this is on the table, but I really don't think this is where this is going. I very much hope this is 2.1, but, you know, this is all I can say. This is very much a work in progress and to be seen. I just think it's important to find the answer, whatever it is. And I think with that, I stop here. That's it.
Hi, Robin. Hi, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you think it's likely that the hypothesis 2.1 will be fulfilled, where the mildly extending index matching rooted circuits just corresponds precisely to rooted circuits?
That's a good question. The answer is no. So it's maybe I should have said that. This example that doesn't have this decomposition, I think it's also clear with the same sort of intuition, without going into the details now, that it doesn't have a decomposition in just rooted circuits.
It has no decomposition in any rooted circuit.
That is our current understanding, yes.
That's extraordinary. Are you sure?
Well, as sure as I can be. But, you know, Augustin and I, we've thought lots about his example, and that is our understanding at the moment, yes. There is some diagrams you can draw that seem to make sense. And you know, this is not a bizarre unitary that you sort of implicitly defined and you don't really understand what it really does. It's very concrete. You perfectly understand what's going on, defined on a basis, and you can draw a diagram. But this diagram that you draw really is not, cannot be made sense of as a rooted circuit that is not index matching.
It is a new example. Is this a new example that came up very recently?
Yeah, this is fairly recent. Yeah, the past few weeks that Augustin and I have been thinking about it.
Okay, I see. Because he had another example when we first wrote the rooted circuits paper, which showed some things cannot be written as just index matching circuits.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not. And I guess it was always a question whether index matching are enough, or whether you might have to move to non-index matching rooted circuits, and the answer is no, but it's also not enough to have rooted circuits.
Right.
That's at least our current understanding.
Okay. You know. Well, that's a very nice result.
Well, it's not a
very
result,
powerful.
It's an impression so far. Yeah.
No, but wait, didn't you say that you have a proof that this thing cannot be drawn?
Well, we don't have a really hard proof that would convince everyone. It's just when you think about it, it becomes kind of clear it's impossible for there to be this decomposition. But this is not the same as that.
But there's no proof.
No, so but I'm basically convinced.
Proof. Okay.
But this, I think, is a matter of formalizing the intuition, right?
Okay,
but you're right.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Something could happen that I've overseen, and there is one. Yeah. I can't say more about it, really.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's very interesting. So I look forward to hearing the result when you solve it.
Yeah, it means new excitement, I suppose. There's something new to figure out.
Yeah, great. Well, that's very interesting to hear today. So I'm glad I came, even though I'm not here and cannot see you. Okay.
See you later. Yeah?
Regarding the realizability of arbitrary causal structures. You said for any causal structure I write down between the inputs and the outputs, there's some choice of dimensions of those inputs and outputs such that I can find a unitary with that causal structure. Do you know whether, I can imagine that being true by, you know, making sure that every one of the inputs is non-prime dimensional, and can be factorized. Like, let's say input one goes to seven different outputs, then it has to have dimension that I can split up into seven parts. You know, that I can do it that way, and then I get a circuit decomposition. Do you know that it's possible to find examples of unitaries for any causal structure that necessarily aren't a circuit decomposition? Like, I give you some arbitrary causal structure, and then I say, now show me I can realize this, but a circuit doesn't do it. Or is it possible that there's some of them that's, it's only circuit decompositions?
Like, only circuits are not.
Just as an example, is there any reason to think that, or even the earlier example with the index matching grounded circuits, is there any reason to think that such examples can be constructed kind of for arbitrary causal structures of sufficient complexity?
I'm not sure I understood the last part. So in the middle, it sounded like, are there cases where a given causal structure is such that if you fix the dimensions of the systems in a particular way, there is a decomposition, but it can't be a circuit decomposition? Is that what you were asking?
Yeah.
So I guess our canonical example would be an example, right? As soon as you have this common cause in the middle of prime dimensional, say a qubit, there is a decomposition, but it's not a circuit decomposition.
But I'm not asking, you know, do there exist such causal structures, but rather, maybe I'll put it this way. Do we have an understanding of what kinds of causal structures necessitate going beyond circuits? So if there's only two inputs and two outputs, we know we can get away with just plain old circuits. Is it possible that there's causal structures with, you know, 17 inputs and 30 outputs, and there's a very specific causal structure where it's like, oh yeah, the only realizations of this are circuit realizations as well. There are no index matching routed circuit realizations of that, just like there are none for the cases of two inputs and two outputs. Does that make sense, my question, or no?
I don't know, maybe I'm being a bit thick here. But I mean, no matter how high a number you...
Situations that can be... Do you know if you've already found all of the cases that can be covered with unitary decompositions?
Or circuit decomposition?
No, we don't know that. But basically, I think it's already clear that even with, you know, arbitrary many high number of inputs and outputs, there will be causal structures for which there's an implied circuit decomposition, and hence you don't need to go beyond circuits to always decompose that particular causal structure.
Right.
Is that what you were asking? Is that kind of... I mean, there's no proof that... I guess you want the classification result that says all the causal structures you can do with circuits, here they are, because it should be easy. I think that might be doable, but we haven't done that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to know how generic the tough cases are, basically.
Right? It's a good question.
That's sort of what I'm interested in. Which
good question. I actually don't know. I mean, back when we were thinking about it, all these cases seem sort of equally hard for kind of the same reasons. And we only ever really thought very hard about this one, not the other ones, ever since we wrote the paper. Now, if you move to, I don't know, five inputs and five outputs, how many are hard? You know, the question is, I guess, will the doable ones dominate, or the not doable ones, or they're kind of the same, or what's the ratio? A good question, I don't know.
Thanks.
Matt, you?
The specific unitary... It's the thing you almost have a proof of, that there's no decomposition in this form that you expect, or that there's
no
decomposition in any form whatsoever.
It's the former, not the latter. So the extent to which you think it is true that there's no causally faithful decomposition within index matching rigid circuits is mostly the extent to which you think this is the only good candidate. But given that all four inputs and all four outputs are qubits, you just have two one-dimensional subspaces you can work with, there's not that much you can do. But you're right. It depends on how much credibility you assign to this guy. We've tried to come up with other things. If you have the idea of what it could be, then that'd be great.
You're saying that you can show simply the factorization thing on causal for causal DAGs without appealing to the strong subadditivity with equality thing?
Yes.
Can you?
Here it is. So at the top is just a reminder, CJ. Representation, you know, for our convention, because that matters here. And then this is just a general fact, easy to convince oneself. If you have a composition of two unitaries, SV, you can basically pull the first one. You could also do it with the second one, doesn't matter. The first one out, in the sense that the CJA representation of this composite is equal to the representation of the later one composed with, on the right-hand side, this operator that contains S, or S dagger, and on the left-hand side, S. So there's a transpose to do with our particular convention with having dual spaces. But that's sort of a well-known fact just about CJ representation. So once that's the case, then you consider unitary from A to B1, B2. And what you want to show is that the CJ representation factorizes into B1 given A and B2 given A, right? And you start with this unitary, you just do a trivial extension and conceive of it as the composition of U with the identity of B1 and B2. And then you pull U out, the identity factorizes, hence also the CJ representation does, and then you just insert identities here in gray, I think. Yeah. And then this line is an operator that is exactly of the form of B1 given A, an identity on the rest, and similarly here, and then you're done, and that just by iteration goes to as many output systems you want. And then if you want the actual parents, you just impose the inference constraints, and hence these marginals have to have trivial action on the complement of the parents, and that's it.
Sorry, what do you mean if you want the actual parents?
Yeah, so here I just said A, right? Yeah. Causal structure is there's no interesting causal structure if there's just one input system without the factorization. Now, when you bring in the factorization, of course you want the statement of the theorem that says CJ operator factorizes into a row AI given parents of AI. So it makes reference to this factorization in the input. And all I'm saying is you really need this factorization, and then the causal structure of the unitary tells you that this marginal channel has to act trivially on the complement of the parent sets. So this factor is all you need to prove this theorem, basically.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. Thank you.
So this is really, I mean, you could always say this is one step.
Yes, this is your two-line proof that you...
Yeah. It makes sense to me. I hope it's correct.
It's three lines.
Well, this is just to be pedagogical. I mean, really, you could do this in one step, I think.
Can I ask a question? This could be a comment if you don't want to say anything.
So this could be a what?
This could be a comment if you don't want to respond with anything, because I see that it falls not within your main interest, but I see that it could fall within the interest of some audience, especially. Well, this question wouldn't be asked if you give a talk in, say, Institute of Quantum Computing, but the Perimeter Institute, we care about physics, so let me make this comment. It's about your hypothesis 1.0. Could you go to that slide?
I'm not sure there's a way to do this. Oh, wow. Where did we have this? There's not much apart from that statement.
Yes. However, there could be much if one think of space-time physics. For example, if I think of the unitaries of a fundamental physical theory, like some quantum field theory, which is based on classical space-time, there I have space-time regions to refer to. And I'm wondering whether this hypothesis, it's still false there. Because there I can say, take my unitaries to be localized in space-time regions. I just partition my space-time into regions of that could connect to each other through shared boundaries. I say that each region has a unitary, if the process is a unitary. And in this case, it seems I can have a circuit decoupled. I'm not sure about this, but it's possible that I just draw a circuit. Each region is represented by a node, and nodes are connected if the regions are neighboring regions, sharing a boundary. And then I can say the two regions are causally connected if the regions are causally connected as space-time regions. Shouldn't this be causally, so shouldn't this be a faithful circuit decomposition?
So to my mind, But maybe people here have more intelligent things to say about it. These are kind of independent questions, right? I guess it's clear that here we just didn't worry at all about how these systems are embedded into some space-time. We just asked about the properties of these maps and what these properties implied in terms of algebraic structure, right? And then certain causal structures are not even, you know, independent of how you decompose it, not in keeping with relativity if you embed the systems in a certain way into space-time, right? So you always have to respect the constraints relativity would impose on an embedding. But I think what you're asking is that somehow is there a reason why the sorts of causally faithful decomposition this is about kind of becomes irrelevant if once you have fixed your embedding into space-time and all you care about, you know, the physical meaning these systems then have in this concrete realization or something like that. And I think the answer is no. I'm not sure this is relevant to you, but you know, can you see this?
Let me try to enlarge. Yes, I see a box.
Okay, yeah, maybe I should draw this larger. I don't know.
It's pretty clear now.
Okay, good. So suppose this case with two inputs. One concrete unitary with this causal structure that is very helpful to sort of think about. I mean, it was a pedagogical example for us. Is this circuit? So you have two C knots. So just suppose now this is a situation where these correspond to qubits and there's some particles in your ontology, and this is sort of embedded into space-time such that what this effective circuit description is getting at is that two systems come into contact in one region of space-time and interact unitarily. We just assume now, for the sake of the argument, this is described by this C naught. And then the left one sort of goes off some other way, and the right one goes into some other region that where it interacts with a cert. So sort of this circuit seems to get something right about this situation where we have embedded systems into space-time. Is that okay so far?
I think I understand the overall point you want to make, which is you can have this circuit describing a physical situation where the rooted description is necessary. Is that
What I'm saying is that there's nothing wrong with drawing this circuit. This is clearly describing not only one no inference condition, but it's actually getting something right and informative about the situation in terms of physics, that if you drew it the other way, which sort of information theoretically, you know, in terms of the map it is mathematically is the same, which is this, you know, it's the same map and expresses another no inference condition, but it's not what we would want to draw. Somehow this circuit is more meaningful because it somehow corresponds better to the fact that we have this region of space time here where they interact and then this later one. And yet I would want to somehow have the mathematical understanding in terms of the subalgebras and how the systems interact that expresses the fact that even though there is this kind of alignment in space-time, this system does not influence that. So what I would want to draw is a fine-grained version of this circuit rather than that. And so here the three systems coming in and out, and the idea here is that somehow you do want to draw a circuit like here and then be able to say, well, this system that is intermediate in going over there decomposes in this way where you can exactly point to the, sorry, in this way, where this middle intermediate system, which is also, you know, isomorphic to a qubit, decomposes in a particular way that tells you how it is the case that this circuit is is meaningful and informative about the situation in space-time, and yet that this system does not influence that one, because the subalgebra that goes from here just goes through this wire there and not over here. I'm not sure this is helpful, but I think this is how... Well, not sure I have more helpful things to say about it.
I totally see that there's a point to your motivation. The comment I want to make is not challenging your motivation anyway. I mean, you're doing whatever you're doing that's meaningful. The comment is about the relevance of what you do to some theory like quantum field theory. Yeah. Because if I understood your presentation correctly, the motivation for the rooted formalism is hypothesis 1.0, and the motivation is that it's false. That's the motivation for the rooted formalism. Is that correct?
I mean, the motivation is just the spirit somehow it ought to be possible to give a compositional account of causal structure and track the subalgebra. Whatever 1.0, 2.0, 2.1, whatever it is, I just want the right language to understand and track how the subalgebras decompose and interact and go.
It's so great. Then it seems we have more common ground than I thought we had. So you say even if hypothesis 1.0 is true, you still find this mission of finding a decompositional description. Interesting task. So if that's the case, then my question is, if I give you a quantum field theory, and I say I want to circuit decompose this theory into space-time regions, and space-time regions only, I partition the space-time region. For each region, I associate a unitary. And it seems to me, hypothesis 1.0 is true.
It's not true. I mean, you can do this, but it's not going to be causally faithful. It's not that circuit expresses all the causal constraints that overall obtain, because causal constraints are a very global thing, right? You can draw a circuit diagram and actually make every box faithful by just the fact that it's just everything influences everything. And yet when you compose them, the overall causal structure has non-trivial constraints that you won't see in the circuit.
So the causal structure I see is the space-time causal structure. If two regions are space-like separated, and if I understand QFT correctly, there's no causal influence between the regions.
Right, so that notion is what I would call relativistic causality. That's imposing constraints on what can possibly be causally related to what. But it doesn't define what it means for things to be causally related. And that is what where subalgebras get mapped through unitaries does do. And then when you embed them, some of these relations are allowed and some others are not. But this is how...
I'm discussing is under the assumption that I've given you a QFT and the unitary is given to you already by the theory. You have, say, a Lagrangian density or a Hamiltonian density that determines the unitary of all space-time regions.
Yeah.
The unitaries are fixed. In that case, I can forget about space-time, forget about relativistic causality. Just look at the unitaries of these regions. And then I can infer from the unitaries whether two regions are causally connected. And it seems this causal relation should agree with the relation from space-time causal relations. If QFT is what we understand it is.
Yeah.
And in this case, with a given QFT, I'm not seeing how hypothesis 1.0 is false.
I'm not sure what I... Okay, no, it seems...
maybe this could be a longer discussion, but basically the question is, can you show me by referring to a particular QFT that hypothesis 1.0 is false? That's the question.
Oh, easy question. The answer is no, I cannot. I have a particular example of a QFT. you know, I believe it's possible to come up with one, but I don't have one here right here to prove this point to you in terms of a particular QFT. But I'm convinced that one can.
How much do you want to bet money on this? I bet with more than, say, 77% confidence that for regular QFTs, you can't show this, even give you enough time.
So I didn't catch that. Sorry, say again.
So you're saying you believe you can't find a particular QFT which shows hypothesis 1.0 is false. Is that right?
I believe one can, yes.
Yes, I'm asking you if you want to take a bet on this. I give you infinite amount of time, but don't come up with some exotic, you know, because
no, I don't bet. But I'm happy to talk about it some other time.
Yes, yes, I believe this is scientifically, even without betting, this is a good question, but maybe this is a longer discussion.
Right. Thanks, Ding.
All right. Sorry, Robin, can I ask one really quick question before we end the talk? So I'm still very intrigued by your example from Augustin. So I wanted to ask, do you know if it's possible to make a rooted circuit decomposition of that unitary that is causally faithful, if you allow also convex combinations of rooted circuits?
I don't know, but I'm not even sure how that would give you a unitary overall. I mean, a combination of two unitaries.
Oh, yes. Yes. Sorry. Not convex combination. What I mean is, superposition. I don't know if that even makes sense. Superposition of two diagrams. But maybe that is already what is included in the rooted circuit. So maybe that doesn't even make it. Rooted circuits already allow you to draw superpositions of different circuits.
Exactly, in a way that's what
the superposition of circuits. Yes. Yeah, so the superposition of circuits, rooted circuits, almost. I don't know if there's if that even makes sense.
Yes. I mean, I would say if you look at a slice like this. This thing is, you know, the direct sum of the unitaries and has a lot to do with superposition. I'm not sure what do you mean that the overall unity should be
like. I don't know if there's a way to have a rooted circuit and then sum with another rooted circuit and sum inside. I mean, sum inside the pure theory, so not sum of the CPM, but the.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So before rooted circuits came, we can always draw, anything can be drawn as sums of circuits, right? For example, quantum switch, something that cannot be drawn as a circuit, can be drawn as a sum of, causally ordered circuits. For example, that's an example. Then rooted circuits allow you to draw this as one circuit. Now, if you tell me something cannot be drawn as a rooted circuit, is there a way to go back to meta level of rootedness? Sorry, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I'm not quite following.
My thoughts are going ahead of myself. I'll try to explain to you another time what I mean. It's a bit difficult to explain.
Sure. Okay. Rob, do you want to
drawing it? But okay.
If you have a unitary where the you could find some circuit decomposition that would capture all the known Flint's conditions, and if you could find many such circuits, suppose it wasn't just one that could capture all the known Flint's conditions, but I could write down sort of distinct possibilities, each of which would capture the known Flint's conditions. Then you can imagine you might have a note with him that says, no one of these can do it. I can't prove it. But then I think the idea would be something, but if I allowed a superposition of them so that that the thing would not just be one circuit, but kind of a superposition of circuits that have different structures, and maybe that's what I need to implement the unitary.
Right, then in that case you would just need some extra systems that you could sort of coherently condition on being one or the other, and it's a different problem, right? You need to bring in more systems and not just ask, can I call the faithful decompose a unitary with fixed systems? Is that fair?
I think so. It's a bit like what we talked about previously about isometric decompositions,
right.
I think.
Okay, Claire, let's will you be here next week?
Yes, will you be here next week?
Yes.
Oh, really? For how long?
Okay, right.
Well, yeah. Until when will you be here, Robin?
Till next Friday.
Yeah, till next Friday.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'll see you next week. I'll be back Monday evening.
Right, see you then.
Okay, I have to go now, so thanks for the talk.
Yeah, welcome.
Let's thank Robin.